I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection!
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes! Yes, I killed Ned Thompson!
I killed him!
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 290. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres, belt and suspenders lawyer. How are you doing?
I'm okay, Thomas. I've come up for air.
Yep.
I'm still bobbing around at the top of the tank and flailing my arms, but I'm no longer in danger of drowning, I think. So,
well, that's good. How are you? Yeah, I mean, the news is not good, but, you know, our show has a job to do, and we should do it. Yep. I can't wait to hear the rationalization of why a 4,000-foot cross is not a religious thing. I just can't wait. You know, it'll be fun. I'll have to enjoy this in an ironic sort of way. We're going to talk about the Bladensburg cross, and we're also going to talk about executive privilege, which I've learned from Donald Trump is a thing you can just shout, like, when you were playing tag as kids and you're like, base. And you just, that means you're fine. Like, yeah, it's like that. Is that the,
yeah, the Trump floor theory? Is indeed lava. So.
The Trump theory of executive privilege, I think, is that. And we'll see, as always, we'll see if Andrew leaves himself enough time for the C segment. You know, the C segment should be a wild card. It really should. It should be like, it's just, it's Schrodinger's C segment. It's, is that quite right? I'm not sure what the best description is, but it's whether or not we leave enough time for it. It both exists and it doesn't right now. We're not sure. But we'll try to measure it.
I like renaming it from the C segment to the Heath segment. It'll be our wild card segment.
Yeah, the wild card segment. That's a good idea. Okay. So get to it. Let's start leaving enough time and we'll see where we are. Here we go.
Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Every lawyer is tempted.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
Not only to eat forbidden fruit, but to become the snake.
State or federal court?
I have not.
Why am I persecuted here?
So yeah, I mean, just as if I were to put up a 90-foot Islamic crescent, I'm sure that the Supreme Court would love it and be like, and Republicans would be like, we love it, you're practicing a religion, we're all for that, right? So just like that, how did this Bladensburg cross case go 7-2 the wrong way?
Yeah, so let's dig into this as much as we can. Again, reminder, go back episodes 256 and 274. We dissected this case first with Sarah Henry of the American Humanist Association, who talked about the facts. And, you know, that's a lot of those got lost at the Supreme Court. And then 274, that's actually one of my favorite episodes. Monica Miller, just amazing guest, and she's going to come back on the show, and we're going to find out what her take is. My take is this is a disaster. This is the second worst possible outcome that we could get in a sheaf of really bad outcomes, right? And I'm going to explain why in a minute. Remember, right? So the facts are as you described. Bladensburg, Maryland, maintains on government property a 80 billion foot tall Latin cross. It is plainly a Christian cross, and the Supreme Court does not dispute that. What they say, I'll just do this as a sidebar because there's a ton of analysis here that's so blatantly pretextual. They say that the cross, although initially imbued with a religious meaning, has taken on a secular meaning.
And why? Indeed, because there are instances
in which the message is almost entire. The message of a 40-foot cement cross is entirely secular. You know what? I'm actually going to read from the opinion. I was going to skip this, but it's so ridiculous. I'm going to read from the opinion. Again, this is a 7-2 opinion. And this is not the scary part, right? So a cross appears as part of many registered trademarks held by businesses and secular organizations, including Blue Cross Blue Shield, the Bayer Group, and some Johnson & Johnson products. Many of these marks relate to healthcare, and it is likely that the association of the cross with healing had a religious origin, but the current use of these marks is indisputably secular. The familiar symbol of the Red Cross, a red cross on a white background, shows how the meaning of a symbol that was originally religious can be transformed. The International Committee of the Red Cross selected that symbol in 1863 because it thought to call to mind the flag of Switzerland, a country widely known for its neutrality. That's true. The Swiss flag consists of a white cross on a red background. That's true. In an effort to invoke the message associated with that flag, the ICRC copied its design with the colors inverted. That's true. Thus, the ICRC selected this symbol for an essentially secular reason, and the current secular message with the symbol is shown by its use today in nations with only tiny Christian populations. That's true. But the cross was originally chosen for the Swiss flag for religious reasons. That's not entirely true and is entirely irrelevant. So, an image that began as an expression of faith was transformed. The image used in the Bladensburg Memorial, a plain Latin cross, also took on new meaning after World War One. And then I could just—I mean, I'm not going to go through. It will just make you angry. But that's the factual holding of the Supreme Court, right? That is this giant 40-foot cross. And by the way, like the Red Cross is a plus, right? Like, I mean, you know, this is unmistakably a Jesus on the cross kind of Latin cross, right? That the Latin cross in the Bladensburg case is originally religious, but has now taken on a secular connotation. That's bad. Look, we knew that result was happening, right? Monica Miller said, yeah, we get it. The Supreme Court's probably going to find a way to say that this is not a religious symbol.
Yeah.
Remember that the issue at stake here was, is the Supreme Court going to overturn the Lemon Test with respect to how we determine whether there is separation of church and state in this country? American Legion explicitly advocated that the Supreme Court overturn the Lemon decision. The Supreme Court almost overturned the Lemon decision in this case. Okay, and I'm going to read what they did in a minute and explain what happened there. Right, the Lemon Test is Lemon versus Kurtzman, 1971, and it says that when you are challenging government action for purposes of the Establishment Clause, you look to see whether that government action, it must meet three criteria, and it must meet all three of them, right? Number one, that government action must have a secular purpose. Number two, that's the purpose prong. Number two, the effects prong, its primary or principal effect must neither advance nor inhibit religion. That is, it must be religiously neutral. That is the effects prong. And number three, and look, this is where the academic criticism has largely focused of the Lemon Test over the years. It must not foster, quote, an excessive government entanglement with religion, end of quote. And I would be lying if I told you that liberal scholars haven't challenged the Lemon Test. I'm like, yeah, what does excessive entanglement mean, right? Like, and look, it's not a great phrase, right? It has been challenged. It's hard to apply, but taken together, right? I've been a staunch defender of the Lemon Test. It gives us something approaching the original intent, right? What the founders meant with respect to separation of church and state, right? Like, that is, you have to be trying to do something secular. You can't benefit or hurt religion, and you kind of got to stay out, right? And look, we're not saying government, right, that we don't want to craft a rule that says government can't do anything that ever touches a church, right? Because right? Because that would be crazy, right? That would mean you couldn't provide, you know, a government fire engine couldn't put out a burning church in its community. And we don't want that, right? And similarly, it would mean, you know, potentially at the other extreme, you know, a church could grant sanctuary to, you know, O.J. Simpson pulling in his white Bronco and, you know, running in seeking sanctuary in the church and being like, oh, sorry, you know, police can't set foot onto church. You don't want that either. Right. So the court, in recognizing we're going to avoid those two extremes, was like, yeah, right. We can.
Yeah.
There's some, but we can't be excessively entangled. And again, could it have chosen those words better? Probably. But has this been largely workable for 48 years? It has been.
So the official OA position has been pro-lemon test. Our platform. And now I'm curious whether they bent these facts to somehow fit that test, or do they decided we don't need that test anymore?
Yeah, and I'm gonna get to that. But before we do, as you pointed out, this is a 7-2 decision.
Yeah,
it is the same alignment as the Trinity Lutheran case. So we have lost Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer. And as we said in Friday's show, this means that, and I would describe them now as sort of moderate accommodationists, right? I don't see how you can sign on to this opinion, but they did. And this is now two in a row on religious liberties issue. And so, you know, we need to understand that we have five hardcore accommodationists on the Supreme Court. And that is the view that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause does not prohibit the state from advancing religion. It just can't, you know, create like the Church of England. That's a preposterous view. I'm not going to get into, lots of people have dissected Clarence Thomas's idiotic concurrence in this, in which he argues that the Establishment Clause was not incorporated out to the states. We've talked about what the incorporation doctrine, but literally that would mean if the Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts decided to have an established church, that, you know, too bad. That literally it only applies to Congress and not to the states, which is an astonishing, stupid, horrible, evil view. But I got to think that even the rest of the Howler Monkey contingent is not going to endorse that view. We'll see. But in addition to the five accommodationists, which is all you need, we also have two votes for sort of moderate accommodationism. We only have two votes left on the court. Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who dissented in this case, who I would describe as reliable, strict separationists. This is going to be, right, future law students will look at this period and, you know, a couple of years beforehand as the nadir, as the lowest point in our nation's history in terms of Establishment Clause.
You think we've hit it, huh? Terms of that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, we may also get the lowest point in the history of the Supreme Court.
Maybe overshadowed by the Supreme Court saying concentration camps are okay. That might be overshadowed by that. We'll see.
That lots of bad stuff is coming, but what I mean by that is we're reaching a point in which both prongs of the First Amendment's religious clauses, both the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause, are really being stripped of their powers as individual rights, at least with respect to everybody who is not a member of a majority religion. Right. We have Employment Division versus Smith, which says you don't get a Free Exercise Clause if you're one of those goofball Native American religions. Notice that I'm characterizing Antonin Scalia there. That's not how I'm actually characterizing Native American beliefs. But Scalia says you don't get a Free Exercise Clause belief for, as an exception to neutrally applicable laws, you know, unless, of course, you know, you're a Christian and you were treated disrespectfully, as we're going to talk about in a minute. And now here in the American Legion versus American Humanist Association case, we've now gutted most of the Establishment Clause as well. So having editorialized that, what does the court say? It says this. And again, this is page 15 to 16 of the opinion, seven votes. Quote, the Lemon test presents particularly daunting problems in cases, including the one now before us, that involve the use, for ceremonial, celebratory, or commemorative purposes, of words or symbols with religious associations. Together, that's it, right? It's bad when you're using stuff that has religious connotation to it. Together, these considerations counsel against efforts to evaluate such cases under Lemon and towards application of a presumption of constitutionality for longstanding monuments, symbols, and practices. That's what the court held. The court says Lemon test does not apply when we are talking about public prayers, when we're talking about monuments, when we're talking about symbols, when we're talking about invocations. What? Anything that is religion in the public square no longer gets evaluated by the Lemon test, by those three prongs that we talked about, and now is evaluated by a, quote, presumption of constitutionality, end of quote.
Well, that's a sweet deal.
Yeah.
How do we get that but for good things?
Like, yeah, I don't know.
Any gun control legislation, let's stop with any of the tests and just say, it's probably constitutional. Let's just assume that limiting gun control, rights is constitutional. How do you get that sweet deal? I don't get it.
So here's how you get that sweet deal. And this is perhaps the most unfortunate Andrew was right segment in the history of the show. We discussed Masterpiece Cake Shop in episode 180. And while everybody was saying, this is, narrow and this and that, I said the dangerous thing about the Masterpiece Cake Shop opinion is not that, it remanded, is not even the outcome, but it is that Justice Kennedy, out of whole cloth, completely made up a brand new test with zero citation to any authority. I read it then. I'm going to read it now. Phillips, that was the hate baker in that case, was entitled to the neutral and respectful consideration of his claims in all the circumstances of the case, right? And that was the deciding that he had to bake the rainbow wedding cake. The neutral and respectful consideration to which Phillips was entitled was compromised here, however. The Civil Rights Commission's treatment of his case has some elements of a clear and impermissible hostility towards the sincere religious beliefs that motivated his objection. And as I pointed out at the time, that's supported by zero case law. We have no idea what neutral and respectful consideration of your sincere religious beliefs means. That this was just making up a whole new area of law. It comes from nowhere. It's definitely not coming from the First Amendment. It definitely does not come from the history or tradition of this country. It's just time for us to make a new test.
Yeah.
That language is reiterated in the conclusion here in the Bladensburg Cross case. Here's what the court says. The cross is undoubtedly a Christian symbol. And again, that's the beginning, right? This is the conclusion.
End of case closed. Right,
of a case, right. If Lemon applies, right, when you say
9-0 decision.
Yeah, the cross is undoubtedly a Christian symbol. Right, that. But that should not blind us to everything else that the Bladensburg Cross has come to represent. For some, the monument is a symbolic resting place for ancestors who never returned home. For others, it is a place for the community to gather and honor all veterans under this cross, and their sacrifices for our nation. Another sidebar, I participated in the AHA's Honor Them All rally, Honor Them All, not Honor Them All. And it was really moving, right, to see veterans of wars of other faiths and descendants of World War I veterans of other faiths saying, Christians telling us that a Christian symbol honors us is not helpful.
No kidding. I mean, else would honor all the secular things that it's trying to say it's doing now, like the non-Christian things, is any other symbol that's not exclusively one religion symbol.
Kind of weird. Like, you can walk through Washington, D.C., and there are lovely monuments everywhere of delightful anyway. For others still, it is a historical landmark. For many of these people, this is the critical part, for many of these people, destroying or defacing the cross that has stood undisturbed for nearly a century would not be neutral and would not further the ideals of respect and tolerance embodied in the First Amendment. For these reasons, the cross does not offend the Constitution. So you see what happens there, right? This is the idea that if the government does something that is blatantly pro-Christian, and then you go to fix it, that would not embody respect and tolerance towards the Christians who are happy about the fact that you've set up a pro-Christian monument. That is mind-boggling that 7 of our 9 Supreme Court justices were like, yeah, no, that seems right. It's absolutely preposterous. Look, it led Kagan and Breyer to write a separate concurrence. And you're going to be angry reading this case, but you know, I recommend reading that concurrence because we've been trying to figure out where Stephen Breyer stands, right? We've talked about how in his decision in Van Orden, upheld one Ten Commandments monument on the same day that he struck down another Ten Commandments monument. In that concurrence, Breyer, joined by Kagan, finally explains that view. He says, the case would be different, in my view, if there were evidence that the organizers had, quote, deliberately disrespected members of minority faiths, or if the cross had been erected only recently, rather than in the aftermath of World War I. But those are not the circumstances presented to us here, and I see no reason to order this cross torn down simply because other crosses would raise constitutional concerns. So for Breyer, we now have, in his own words from his concurrence, that, you know, the amount of time something has been up is dispositive in terms of whether it is a violation of the First Amendment. I don't know how that's a tenable logical position, but look, like at least we now, you know, have clarity on his opinion. The Howler Monkey contingent on this court makes it very, very clear that they do not subscribe to that belief. And there are multiple separate concurrences. And, you know, those concurrences also triumphantly pronounce the death of the Lemon Test in its entirety. And I think that the next Establishment Clause case that comes before the Supreme Court is just going to, in a footnote, say, oh, the Lemon Test was implicitly overruled in American Legion versus American Humanist Association. It isn't yet, but it's hard to imagine a situation now that would involve the Lemon Test that you could get 5 votes from this court. So in my view, really, really, it's you know, a hair's breadth away from the worst possible outcome. And it's exactly, you know, what I was worried was going to happen. We're going to bring Monica on the show, and maybe she's got some room for optimism. I don't know, but looks real bad.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've kind of answered this, but I was actually curious. The first question I wanted to ask you was, like, what officially determines whether or not we've gotten rid of the Lemon Test? You know, like, because a lot of times you've got these concurrences and justices are agreeing on different things, you know, but they're disagreeing, but for different reasons. Like, do they have to get together and, like, actually have almost a separate vote of, like, okay, how many people are ruling that, you know, the cross is okay, but for this reason, and how many people are ruling the cross is okay because screw the Lemon Test, we're getting rid of it? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And so I want to break down, like, from a lawyer practicing, what that means. So a couple of different components to your question. The first is, remember that particularly at the Supreme Court, where you talk about having multiple concurrences and people join in different parts of the opinion, when you are sort of piecing together what the holding is the most narrow thing to which the majority of the justices have agreed, right? So in this case, right, that is, there are 7 votes for the entirety of the opinion minus section 2A. It's not worth going into sort of precisely what Kagan and Breyer carved out in 2A, but that does not include the 2A, I should say 2A and 2D. So that it would not be part of the holding. But nevertheless, the holding that I read to you, which comes from pages 15 to 16, that is the end of that is the introduction to B, which to which all seven justices joined. Okay, so this case, the holding of this case, right, will be that the lemon test is, and I'll read the specific language. These four considerations, right? And again, I didn't go into the distinction, but they're just four criticisms of the lemon test, show that retaining established, religiously expressive monuments, symbols, and practices is quite different from erecting or adopting new ones. The passage of time gives rise to a strong presumption of constitutionality. Okay. Seven votes for that sentence. So that is part of the holding of this decision and has precedential effect and has binding effect on all lower courts seeking to figure out how to resolve Establishment Clause cases that come before them. The second part of the question is, how do we determine whether the Lemon test is, whether Lemon v. Kurtzman is overruled? And the answer to that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about legal practice, right? The easiest way is the court in a majority opinion, right, in a holding that I just described, signed on by five or more justices, will say Lemon v. Kurtzman is hereby overruled. Okay. And when that happens, when you are on Lexis or Westlaw and you type in a case, right? If I were to go to Westlaw or Lexis right now and type in Dred Scott versus Sanford, right? I can get the case. It will pull up the opinion, and in the upper left hand corner is a giant red stop sign. And that stop sign tells me this case has been explicitly overruled. There are other symbols that the online reporting services use that indicate negative treatment. And so right now, and I don't know if they have updated it, if you were to pull up Lemon versus Kurtzman, it will show with the signal that says negative treatment. And this case will then show up as the strongest level of negative treatment shy of overruling the case. And that's how, and look, and all lawyers have access to this. So it would be fair and honest, right? Like I can't believe I'm about to give the Alliance Defending Freedom some advice on how to litigate against our friends over at the FFRF. But if you're litigating an Establishment Clause case and the FFRF says, look, this doesn't meet the three prongs of the Lemon test, any lawyer would then write in their opposition brief, the Lemon test has been called into most severe question by the Supreme Court and is of dubious validity in cases like this. And you would be forced as an honest lawyer bringing your case before a district court to agree with that. Now, my prediction then was in the next religious case, in the next term, the next time the Supreme Court takes up an Establishment Clause case, it's going to decide it on different grounds. It's going to decide on this, you know, crazy new test that Anthony Kennedy just made up out of whole cloth, that we have to be, you know, respectful of majority religious beliefs, something, you know, not found in the Constitution and not part of our nation's historical practice. And they're going to say in a footnote, Lemon v. Kurtzman was effectively overruled in this case's opinion in American Legion versus American Humanist Association. And then when five justices vote for that case, then Lemon v. Kurtzman will show up with a big red stop sign in Lexis and Westlaw. That makes sense?
Yeah. But I just wasn't sure. It sounded like you weren't sure. Like so do we know? How much? Yeah, to what extent?
It has not been entirely overruled as of today, right? That's what this opinion says. It says we're not going to apply it in a case like this. But it doesn't say the Lemon Test is no longer good law. But look, like there's right. six pages of here's all the reasons why the Lemon Test is a terrible test. And so that you cannot, the ADF will be, they probably will do this, and they will be misleading and disingenuous to say the Supreme Court has overruled Lemon versus Kurtzman. If they are smart practitioners, they will say the Supreme Court has all but overruled Lemon v. Kurtzman. That's a defensible characterization of this holding, and I don't think it will survive the next case to come before the Supreme Court. I think they're going to turn around. So they wanted to put this in two steps, right? And there are lots of reasons that you could imagine that, you know, if you buy into the institutionalist thesis, right, getting overruling prior precedent in two steps, you know, makes it seem less ominous than overruling it in one. And that's where we are.
Cool. I got nothing. I don't.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to have anything. There's no positive to be drawn out of this.
And that's the end of today's recurring segment. Andrew makes Negatron's job so easy. It barely has to even be done.
Yep, it's bad. There's no spin. There's nothing you can say. There are no silver linings.
I think the
linings.
Only positive spin we can put on it is that we get to have Monica back on our show. Maybe like that's yeah. literally like I'm. That's it. Which is yeah. I mean that's good for us and the listeners, but like it's not great for the country. You know.
No, I would be willing to sacrifice that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'd be willing to never have Monica on the show again if we could have this opinion go the other way.
But alas, that's not what happened. Okay. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Hims, a wellness brand for men. I highly recommend using Hims to avoid those awkward conversations and, by the way, and copays at the doctor's office that might be unnecessary anyway. If you think you might be beginning to lose your hair, and 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35, and once you've started noticing that thinning hair, it can be too late. So if you think you're starting to notice it, is it that hairline starting to move a little bit backwards, getting maybe a little bit of bald spot? The best way to prevent hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some hair to work with. It's time to get a handle on that precious hair. And so why do guys turn to weird solutions or do nothing when they can turn to medicine and science? ForHims.com is your one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and sexual wellness for men. Hims helps guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat hair loss. These aren't snake oil pills. This is why we recommend Hims. These are prescription solutions backed by science. But Hims gets rid of those awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. They connect you to real doctors online, which could save you hours. It's completely confidential and discreet. You answer a few quick questions, and a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, they can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Get the hair loss treatment that everyone is talking about, featured in GQ, Men's Health, Esquire, and Playboy, to name a few. Order now. Our listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last, and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds of dollars if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to forhims.com/OA. That's forhims.com/OA. One more time, go to forhims.com/OA. Well, are we on to bigger and brighter and better things?
Yes, let's head on over to Yodel Mountain.
Oh, Yodel Mountain. A rare Tuesday yodel, everybody. Oh, how nice.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right. Well, executive privilege. What's the latest in Trump's efforts to declare executive privilege over literally anyone and anything and any document and any person ever to kind of cross his path.
Yeah, and this is a little more of a complicated story than you might think. Okay. So I'm glad we're going to get a chance to unpack this. So the White House has asserted executive privilege over Don McGahn and Hope Hicks. McGahn, you guys know, these former chief legal counsel to the White House. He is all over the Mueller report. Infamously noted in his interview with Robert Mueller that Trump ordered him to do, quote, crazy shit, end of quote, and that he wouldn't do it. Hicks, on the other hand, you might remember, was the campaign spokesperson turned communications director. She is the most important witness in the congressional investigation for reasons that we don't fully know. But in episode 259, when we broke down Jerry Nadler's various letters and subpoenas, we pointed out after going through all of them that Hope Hicks's was the most extensive, asked for the most categories of documents, and everything else that every other witness, with a handful of exceptions of people who had kind of idiosyncratic roles, were just subsets of what the House requested from Hope Hicks. Hope Hicks testified last week. She testified on Wednesday, June 19th, behind closed doors to the House Investigatory Committee. That didn't go well. I'm going to read a little bit from the NPR report that says, quote, there's a whole bunch of lawyers in there, says Representative David Cicilline, Democrat from Rhode Island. She's staffed up with many lawyers, her own lawyers, White House counsel lawyers. They're all there to make sure she follows White House directions to not share information to prevent Congress from conducting its oversight. And then, you know, we could go on. But essentially, everybody came out of that testimony and was like, well, that was a giant waste of time. She didn't tell us anything because the White House has asserted executive privilege and then sent its own lawyers there like leg breakers to make sure that she didn't violate executive privilege.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by NetSuite. And let me tell you, folks, NetSuite is after my own heart right now. They probably don't know that I used to be an accountant, but oh, I can't wait for this. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. Oh, I agree so hard with this. Yeah, I've talked to so many small business owners where you ask them any basic questions about inventory or whatever it might be, and they seemingly have no idea what their actual numbers are, what their actual profits are, what their actual unit costs are, anything like that. I'm very excited to talk about NetSuite. Oftentimes, people have one system for accounting, another for sales, and another for inventory, and so on. Or, by the way, just don't have any one or two of those things. This is inefficient, it costs too much time, too many resources, and it hurts the bottom line. This is where NetSuite comes in. NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and the control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/OA. That's netsuite.com, netsuite.com/OA to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. One more time, go to netsuite.com/OA.
So what is that claim? And the Trump administration has released 2 separate letters. I'm going to link them both in the show notes, obviously. One on May 20th, 2019, with respect to McGahn, and then the other a couple weeks later with respect to Hope Hicks, that say this. And here I'm going to read from McGahn's letter. On April 22nd, 2019, the Committee on the Judiciary of the House of Representatives subpoenaed Don McGahn, former counsel to the president, to testify about the Mueller report. You have asked whether McGahn is legally required to appear. And this is you meaning the president. We provide the same answer that the Department of Justice has repeatedly provided for nearly five decades. Congress may not constitutionally compel the president's senior advisors to testify about their official duties. This testimonial immunity is rooted in the congressional constitutional separation of powers and derives from the president's independence from Congress. And then there are a bunch of different citations. So the argument is Congress lacks the power to do this because of separation of churches, because of separation of powers. So first, is this claim true? And the answer is that sentence, right, that begins for nearly five decades, we provide the same answer that the DOJ has repeatedly provided, that Congress may not compel president's senior advisors to testify about their official duties. That is true. That refers back to, but it's true, as is everything that might be true in the Trump administration, it's true with an asterisk.
True in a totally different way than.
So it is a memorandum from Assistant Attorney General William Rehnquist, before he was subsequently elevated to the Supreme Court, to John Ehrlichman, his friend, who was then the assistant to Richard Nixon for domestic affairs. This was written in 1971, put a pin in that, and it says this subject raises the question of executive privilege, right? The power of a congressional committee to compel the appearance or testimony of, quote, White House staff. And it begins with a position that is no longer tenable as a matter of law. And that position is, and again, I'm going to quote from Rehnquist's memorandum, everyone associated with the executive branch has taken the position that the president himself is absolutely immune from subpoena by anyone as the seat of at the seat of government or away from it. This, of course, does not answer the question as to whether his immediate advisors are likewise exempt. That position is not right. Remember, this memo was written in 1971. A lot of stuff happened. 1971 was before the Watergate break-in.
Yeah.
And so a lot of stuff happened in 1972, including Richard Nixon directing his cadre of plumbers to break into the Watergate hotel complex, which came to light in 1972 and 1973. So in 1974, United States versus Nixon, 418 U.S. 683, held that, the quote, even the president may not be absolutely immune from compulsory process, end quote. So in other words, a president does in fact have to deal with a subpoena. That is not the end of the inquiry, and there are many areas in which the president does enjoy absolute immunity. But the idea that the president is completely above the law has been roundly rejected by the Supreme Court for almost as long as this, you know, as the OLC is saying they've taken the position that it hasn't been since 1974. Now, go back to the Rehnquist memo. It then says, it says, look, so president's absolutely immune. That's no longer good law. But that doesn't tell us whether his advisors are immune. Then Rehnquist says, the president and his immediate advisors, that is, those who customarily meet with the president on a regular or frequent basis, should be deemed absolutely immune from testimonial compulsion by a congressional committee. They not only may not be examined with respect to their official duties, they may not even be compelled to appear before a congressional committee. They are presumptively available to the president 24 hours a day, and the necessity of either accommodating a congressional committee or persuading a court to arrange a more convenient time could impair that availability. Okay, so that was Rehnquist's argument, was, look, these people have to be on call 24-7, and they got to take time out of their busy, busy day to answer congressional testimony. That would mean they're not there to talk to the president, and you can't do that.
But Hope Hicks to...
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, that would no longer apply to people who are no longer presidential advisors. Yeah. So Rehnquist knows that, so he also wants to go into the substance of the privilege. And here, Rehnquist, and again, you know, you want to talk about what's happened on the right. Rehnquist concedes in his memorandum that the history here is, quote, tentative and sketchy, end of quote. In other words, that there's not a lot to guide him in terms of figuring out whether congressional staffers should enjoy absolute immunity under executive privilege. And he goes through the history and ultimately comes out in favor of an expansive absolute view of immunity, right? The one in which I described, which says you may not only not subpoena, you may not compel these close advisors to testify in any way whatsoever. That language from Rehnquist in 1971 has then been applied by OLC opinions of both parties, right? And I'm going to upload a Clinton era. This is 20 OLC 308. It is a 1996 opinion put out by the Clinton OLC, which just says, you will see how short it is. It says, you, again, Bill Clinton, have asked whether it be consistent with precedent and governing legal principles to assert executive privilege should a subpoena be issued by a congressional committee to you in your capacity as counsel to the president to compel your testimony, not to Bill Clinton, but to Bill Clinton's legal counsel, to compel your testimony at a committee hearing concerning the performance of your official duties. We believe that executive privilege would be assertable. It is a longstanding position of the executive branch that, quote, the president and his immediate advisors are absolutely immune from testimonial compulsion by a congressional committee. This position is constitutionally based. And then it quotes again from prior memoranda, the president is a separate branch of government. He may not compel congressmen to appear before him. As a matter of separation of powers, Congress may not compel him to appear before it. The president's close advisors are an extension of the president. And again, this is, you know, a page in length. From start to finish. So it is correct.
Seems like weird logic to me, though.
Yeah, it seems really weird.
The president isn't able to do court decisions that would limit the Supreme Court's power, so why could the Supreme Court limit the president?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, that makes no sense. And so the fact that presidents have asserted this interpretation of the law since 1971 is true. The fact that their office of legal counsel, which again is appointed by the president, right? So, you know, you put these are lawyers appointed by the president opining as to whether the president can do the thing that he presumably asked them if he could do before he appointed them to that job. That doesn't mean that their opinions are correct. For that, we would turn to actual case law. And the actual case law suggests that these opinions are not remotely correct. As I told you, all of the legal and factual bases for these opinion letters are built by reference to the 1971 Rehnquist letter. The Supreme Court, and since then, the Supreme Court has chipped away in major ways at the underlying principle, right? So U.S. v. Nixon said, you can issue subpoenas to the president. He's got to turn over documents, right? That's how we got the tapes, the Nixon tapes. He had to respond to a subpoena. Clinton versus Jones said, not only does the president have to respond to a subpoena, but for matters that are outside the performance of his job duties, he has to sit for a deposition in a civil lawsuit, right? So if the underlying idea of absolute immunity isn't true for the president, it's really hard to imagine that his staffers would get automatic absolute immunity by extension, right?
Yeah. And his ex-staffers too.
And his ex-staffers, yeah. And in fact, while there is no upper level precedent on this, there is a really well-reasoned decision from the D.C., the District Court for the District of Columbia in 2008. So again, not binding precedent on anybody, but absolutely where this is headed, right? And we'll talk about that in a minute, is back to this court. And a court reviewing whether to compel Hicks and McGahn to testify is going to look to this decision, which is Committee on the Judiciary versus Myers. I'm going to upload that case because it is not publicly available anywhere that I can find. So here's what happened. In 2006, we've talked about this on the show before, there was a congressional oversight into whether the George W. Bush White House fired a whole bunch of U.S. attorneys for political reasons. And the House Committee on the Judiciary subpoenaed White House counsel Harriet Myers to come testify. And the Bush White House OLC issued out one of these memoranda. Again, one of the memoranda Trump is now quoting quoting the Rehnquist memo, said, nah, she's a presidential aide. She doesn't have to testify. And the court said that OLC briefing is not legally sound. I'm gonna go through some of what that court said. And again, this is a single district court judge. It's not binding even on a subsequent district court judge, but it is really, really instructive. And there's no doubt in my mind that whoever hears the motion to compel on Hope Hicks and Don McGahn is going to read this opinion. So first, it lays out the arguments in the same way that I did. And then it goes to the OLC memorandum and says, and then it says, significantly, Mr. Rehnquist referred to his conclusions as, quote, tentative and sketchy, and then later apparently recanted those views. See U.S. Government Information Policies and Practices, the Pentagon Papers, hearing before the Subcommittee on Foreign Operations and Government Info of the House Committee on Government Operations from 1971, testimony of William H. Rehnquist. I tried to pull up that testimony, and it does not appear to be digitized, so I can't verify this other than it's quoted in a court opinion. So I credit it from that sense, in which Rehnquist testified to Congress, quote, members of the executive branch, ellipsis, have to report, give their name and address and so forth, and then invoke the privilege. So in other words, he backed away from the absolute privilege assertion in his 1971 memo just later in 1971. Then now we're back to the Myers 2008 decision. In Clinton v. Jones, then Chief Justice Rehnquist joined in a holding that even the demands of the president's schedule could not relieve him of the duty to give a civil deposition. And I love that little bit of skewering, right? Remember, we put a pin in that as Assistant Attorney General, Rehnquist's opinion was absolute immunity. When he was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he did not embrace that position, and in fact signed on to an opinion that said the burden on the president's time and energy that is a mere byproduct of such review surely cannot be considered as onerous as the direct burden imposed by judicial review and the occasional invalidation of his official actions. We therefore hold that the doctrine of separation of powers does not require federal courts to stay all private actions against the president until he leaves office, end of quote. So that led the Myers court to conclude, whatever force the Rehnquist memorandum had when written, it retains little vitality in light of Clinton v. Jones. If the president must find time to comply with compulsory process in a civil lawsuit, so too must his senior advisors for a congressional subpoena. I put all of that together, and I want to read kind of one more bit from the Myers opinion. In fact, let me go to the holding. Again, this is a U.S. District Court judge in the same court that to which Congress will now go. It is hard to see how one can square OLC's understandings of the accommodation process with a claim that presidential advisors are, quote, absolutely immune, end quote, from testifying before Congress. If Congress has a legitimate need for the testimony of a senior presidential advisor, e.g., because the advisor is an essential fact witness to wrongdoing, and there is no principled reason to withhold the information, e.g., because of the executive's longstanding position that executive privilege will not be invoked to conceal evidence of criminal or unlawful wrongdoing by executive officials, it would seem that the president would be obligated to permit the advisor to testify. Thus, when Presidents Nixon and Reagan permitted senior advisors to testify about Watergate and Iran-Contra, respectively, they were not merely engaging in acts of presidential grace, but carrying out their constitutional obligations. Any other interpretation would create bizarre inconsistencies in the executive branch position. For example, suppose Congress has a legitimate legislative need for information known only to a senior presidential advisor. If the advisor wrote the information down in a document, the executive branch would have a constitutional obligation, under some circumstances, to produce that document. But if the same information were only in the advisor's head, there would be no constitutional obligation to acknowledge the legislative need for the information, and any accommodation would purely be a matter of political bargaining. This makes no sense. So, look, that's where I come out on this. Hope Hicks stiffed the committee on the House Committee on the Judiciary. Don McGahn isn't even showing up. The next step, as we have talked about on this show, is the judiciary will bring a lawsuit seeking to compel their testimony. That will put all of this in evidence. The fact that they are backed by an Office of Legal Counsel memorandum is worth the paper that it is printed on, but no more. And look, there's no Supreme Court precedent on this, but the district court and, in my view, the circuit court, right, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, I think are very plainly going to uphold the issuance of that subpoena. And then we're going to be before our Supreme Court. But that's where we're headed. So when you see that Hope Hicks testified, there's a bizarre, I'm not a member. It's a Daily Beast, but you have to be a member. It's like exclusive behind the paywall content that says, you know, Hope Hicks just shattered the, you know, did some kind of, no, Hope Hicks totally stiffed the House Judiciary Committee. Don't read anything on the left that says she provided some crucial testimony or blew the roofs off our doors or whatever it is. that's a Matthew Berry joke, by the way.
Oh, okay.
There are like three people out there that play fantasy baseball who are laughing their butts off at that joke. Anyway, so don't believe that on the left, but. You know, don't believe your Uncle Frank on the right when he said, no, it's been well settled law for 50 years. No, it's been well settled opinion by the president's lawyers for 50 years that the president's advisors don't have to show up. But that opinion traces back to a single memorandum that was produced in a tentative fashion that has been cited as absolute authority and for which the factual and legal predicates are no longer remotely in effect. At a district
case closed.
Court.
This is an easy one, but
yeah, it is.
The question
it is
how
one.
Long
yeah.
can they delay with all this? You know, by the time we get through the sternly worded letter phase to the court case to the Supreme Court, like is the goal here to get past 2020 general election?
Yeah, yeah. Look, there. If it yes, right. The goal of the Trump administration right now is to run out the clock. That is absolutely correct. But remember, right. Each of these things that you know, as the dominoes start to fall, you know, will have an effect on the overall view of the public at large, right? Like, you know, the point you've made that. I really like that I continue to use with my friends who have taken the Nancy Pelosi, you know, look, we don't want impeachment to backfire. The public isn't behind impeachment. Right. Is that there's an educating the public process of going through the impeachment process. Having a judicial opinion come out is not the same. Right. I don't mean to suggest that it's a replacement. Right. But I think that there is an analogy to be drawn, right? Like as independent judicial officials say, no, this is nonsense. That can have an effect. And you know, I continue to be shocked. I mean, the major, if you wanted to rechristen this podcast, Andrew was wrong. You know, I thought that by the time we got to here, I thought that there was no way that the Mueller report would shake loose one Republican congressman.
You mean only one?
Only one. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it would be, you know, significantly.
Who, by the way, will get primaried and will be out of there because he was the one Republican who dared to say that Trump did a bunch of illegal stuff.
It, you know, it. that certainly he will be primaried. I thought it was really instructive. I think this was in the John Oliver report that like went to Justin Amash's town hall and interviewed.
Yeah,
one of his constituents who was like, well, I watch Fox News all the time and I had no idea the Mueller report had anything negative in it.
Yep.
Right. And I was like, yeah, that's because you watch Fox News all the time and they lie. You know, I underestimated the degree to which having a propaganda arm of the media and disintermediating the media entirely and communicating directly to your supporters through incoherent Twitter ramblings. I underestimated the effect that that would have on our political process. So I was super wrong about that. And hopefully that doesn't mean that I'm super wrong about everything. We'll find out.
Well, but what's the answer? Do you think they can run out the clock, or like, what's the, if you were to give a guess of how long they can delay?
Look, like this is within a month, you're going to have a lawsuit, and that lawsuit is going to have an expedited briefing schedule because it is going to seek injunctive relief, and injunctive relief gets briefed super quickly because the burden is high, and the district court is going to issue that injunction relatively quickly, right? So I think before the fall, we are going to get an injunction that will then be appealed to the DC circuit. And then, you know, we're going to have to see procedurally, right, how that injunction comes out. And, you know, like I can't now I can't speculate on the appeal of an appeal of an injunction that hasn't been issued yet. but it's going to churn relatively quickly.
Okay. I don't know what that means, but I'll hope that means within
a couple of months, we're going to get an injunction.
Well, that would be
good. That's as concrete a prediction as you're going to get on this show.
Okay. On this particular topic. No, you give us good concrete predictions.
I try.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's that. I think that should be a case closed. It should be one of those no-brainers, but when you have a corrupt administration trying to do everything they can to what's the word? It's almost like obstruct justice is kind of what I'm thinking of.
It's kind of an obstructee,
slow down justice
kind of thing. Yeah.
But that's that. All right. Do we have time for the wild card segment? I guess let's roll the dice. Andrew,
I say we pass, on the wild card segment. We're already at, over an hour.
Brutal. All right. And maybe we can add it to the list of things we can cover on a bonus segment, a wild card episode. A wild card catch-up episode. I love it.
Oh, I love it.
All right. Well, that we will do that. Okay. So that means we've got to hop on over to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. I hope you folks are enjoying the Lot Awful movies. Of course, we've got that's now the middle of the month, and we've got the Q&A, which only patrons get to ask the questions for the Q&A. Everybody can watch, but that's a select privilege for our patrons. We try to give good return on that Patreon investment. So patreon.com/law is where you want to go to get all those goodies. Andrew, why don't you start us off on thanking our new patrons this week?
Yeah. Thanks to Don Ford, voice of fantasy and adventure. Yeah. About time, Don. Thanks for joining up. Doug Connors, Evan Hoover, Michelle D, Emily Spence, Kevin, and Hai from Reddit's OpenArgs subreddit. And I want to give a special shout out to that. That is reddit.com/r/OpenArgs, OpenArgs.
I am going to subscribe to that right now.
I'm going to subscribe to that right now as well.
Reddit app.
So thanks, Hai. Over to you.
I thought they were saying hi, like H-A-I. Oh, it's actually somebody named Hai. Okay, either way.
Yeah, it's Hai too.
Oh, okay. I don't know how to pronounce this one, but Jide Ajibola, something like that, sorry. Yeet the Rich, Jessica Law, James Carr, Koba, and Sarah. Thank you very much for pledging, folks. I hope you enjoy all those benefits aforementioned. Okay, well, it's time to find out how I did on this question. Not, I don't know. A little pessimistic on this one. I'm curious to hear the results. TTTBE, Number 131. Here we go.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Yeah, Thomas, this was a testimonial question. So defendant charged with falsely claiming deductions on her federal income tax return puts a witness on the stand. The witness says this that the defendant has a reputation for complete honesty. And then there's a colloquy up at the with the judge that says, the prosecutor says, look, I want to ask a question introducing a record that the defendant's medical school had disciplined her for altering her transcript. And what I want to ask is, you just testified that they have a reputation in the community for complete honesty. Have you heard that the defendant falsified her medical school transcript? And the question is that question proper? So let's go to your Thomas's Second Chance Bar law firm went with A and D. So you eliminated B and C. B was no, because its minimal relevance on the issue of income tax fraud is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And you eliminated that. That's a good elimination. The point of asking this question is not to prove income tax fraud, but to impeach the witness's credibility, testifying that the defendant has a reputation for honesty. This is not a situation where we are evaluating the prejudicial effect versus the probative value. You also eliminated C, and I really thought this was a helpful discussion. Hopefully Brian left it in, between C and D, which you initially said you weren't sure, you know, you were sort of having trouble parsing the difference between C, probative of the defendant's character trait for dishonesty, and D, that it will impeach the witness's credibility. And then I think you figured it out. It was a really, really good discussion. This would not be admissible as a general rule 405 character evidence, right?
Hmm.
We've done questions like this before that would be, oh, hey, you falsified your medical transcript, therefore you're likely to have falsified your taxes, right? This is the kind of impermissible character testimony that the federal rules of evidence prohibit. So then the question is, is it hearsay, which is A, which you went for, or is it testimony designed to impeach the witness's credibility, which is D? You came so close before going to hearsay. No,
I shouldn't have done it.
I was rooting for you to pull the trigger. The reason it's not hearsay, so this will help you on the next 69 questions. The reason that it's not hearsay is hearsay must, just remember this rule. It was one of the things that I remembered. Hearsay must be for a situation when you are trying to prove, you are offering the statement for the truth value of the statement itself, right? So in other words, here, the prosecution doesn't really care whether it's true that the defendant falsified the medical school transcript or not. Right. He doesn't care about that. Huh. He's not asking the witness, hey, is it true that this defendant falsified? They're just saying no. They're trying to impeach the credibility. They're saying you just testified that this person has a reputation for complete honesty. Yeah. Do you know that they've been accused of this dishonest thing? To which, by the way, the witness, you know, could give an answer. Right. Like would be able to say like, oh, yeah, would either say, I knew about that, but, you know, here's why that was nonsense, or would say, oh, no, I didn't know about that, which would, you know, obviously impeach their testimony quite a bit. So it's not hearsay because we don't care about the truth or falsity of the out-of-court statement itself. That's why it is D and not A. Super close. I really wish I could give you half a point, but the
no, I don't deserve it.
Yep.
I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong after I did it. I was like, nah, I should. And it's rarely, the bar is rarely like, here's this one answer on this, you know, testing this concept, and then three answers that are testing a different concept, you know? And then it's, in my experience on these, it's, I should have known it's not going to be the hearsay thing. Like, it's just, none of the other answers have anything to do with that, you know? And it just felt, I don't know. I should have known that was too easy. I think it, correct me if I'm wrong. Don't you think it rarely does that where it's like, here's all these answers that are based around these, the testing clearly this particular thing, and then here's one on a totally separate thing. It feels like it rarely gives you that one.
I think rarely is the right word, but one of the things that the bar is super devious about is not giving you ironclad rules that
you can ever use
to rule anything out. So it's a fair rule of thumb, but it's not an absolute.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little unclear on that. I guess that, okay, you say that distinction is, it's not, they don't care. So you can ask anything that, like, basically, you don't have to prove anything. Oh, have you ever heard that they murdered their mom? And then she can just say, no. Like, is that how that works?
Well, look, that's a situation you would have to have, right, some kind of...
Under this analysis, I don't understand. He just said, you don't care about the truth or falsehood of the, you know, truth or falseness, I guess it would be, of the statement. So why does it matter? I don't get it.
Right. Well, but there, that's a situation where you would get into a situation where the prejudicial value of the question would outweigh the probative value of the answer, right? So that would come back in to be that you eliminated there, right? Like if something were just completely manufactured, right, you would object on grounds that you would object first on relevance grounds, but you would also object on grounds that the probative value is outweighed by its prejudicial effect.
All right. I guess that seems weird. It seems weird to say it doesn't matter that it's true or false, but then if it is, but it does matter if it's bad enough or something. I don't get how you balance those two things, but okay.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get into that in a future episode, because this is a really good point. What I mean is that the question is, the very narrow application of hearsay is only when you were trying to introduce the facts of the matter themselves. Yeah. So.
Right. All right.
But I see it's a good question, and it deserves a longer explanation that, you know, we can't do here.
I got it wrong. And we'll have to hop in the limited use time machine to announce who got this week's question right.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Hey, Thomas, this week's TTTB winner is Gabe Greenbaum on Twitter, who writes, very simply but straightforwardly incorrect, D, because the witness testified to the honesty of defendant, the witness may be impeached by defendant's specific acts of dishonesty. Concise, clear, correct. Congratulations, Gabe, on being this week's winner. And everyone should give Gabe a follow. That is at GABEYGR33N. So he's elite, I guess. But congratulations, Gabe. And thanks for playing.
Well, I hope they're all enjoying their fame and fortune. There's so much fame and fortune that we've handed out over the years. Is there enough to go around is what I wonder. Like, how much fame and fortune can there be in the world? Seems like it's a fixed resource, but we hand it out like it's nothing. But anyway, hope you enjoy your fame and fortune, winner, that I wasn't this week. All right. We will see you. Well, we could see you sooner than Rapid Response Friday, depending on how this bonus episode thing goes. I'm lobbying for it. We'll see how it goes. So we'll see you when next we release an episode.
Can't wait.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.
It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowellbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.